Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of why inequality has gone up so much with Jared Bernstein, who was up until recently the chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, executive director of the White House Task Force on the Middle Class, and a member of President Obama's economic team. We will discuss the Occupy movement as a countervailing force against income inequality and the impact that a crash of the euro will have on our already weak economy and next year's elections. Then we will discuss the apparent opening up of Burma with the Secretary of State's visit and try to determine both the extent of political reform underway and the broader strategic role that the US is engaged in challenging Chinese influence in a brutalized country emerging from 50 years of oppressive military rule. A specialist on both Burma and Buddhism, Julianne Schober, the director of the Center for Asian Research at Arizona State University, joins us to look through a crack in the wall of repression that has ravaged this resource-rich, strategically important country. Then finally, we will discuss the just-released report by Amnesty International accusing Saudi Arabia of reacting to the Arab Spring by launching a wave of repression. The founder and director of the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia, Dr. Ali Al-Yami, joins us to examine the arrests of the mainly Shia Muslim restive in the mainly Shia Muslim restive eastern province and the fate of those that defy a permanent government ban on protests. Joining us now is Jared Bernstein, who's a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. From 2009 to 2011, he was the chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, executive director of the White House Task Force on the Middle Class, and a member of President Obama's economic team. Prior to joining the Obama administration, Bernstein was a senior economist and the director of the Living Standards Program at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. And between 1995 and 1996, he held the post of deputy chief economist at the United States Department of Labor. He's the author and co-author of numerous books, including Crunch, Why Do I Feel So Squeezed? And 9 editions of The State of Working America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jared Bernstein.
Well, thank you for inviting me on.
And you have a piece at the Huffington Post out now. Why has inequality gone up so much? And before we get the answers to that, just in terms of the political zeitgeist, it would seem that in your article you talk about the need for countervailing forces pushing it back against globalization and technological change. What's your take on the messaging that's come out of the Occupy movement, the 99% versus the 1%?
Well, first of all, let me emphasize and to some extent clarify that I'm not interested in pushing back against technological change or globalization. I'm interested in pushing back against their inequality-inducing effects. That is, it would be, I think, not in the interest of economic growth and improving living standards were we to try to stop the evolution of things like technology in our economy, which historically has been a very important booster to living standards. But without the proper countervailing forces, structures in place that give people more bargaining power such that they can reap some of the gains of economic growth that they themselves are helping to create, the benefits from technological change or globalization do an end run around the middle class. Your second question was about Occupy Wall Street. Yeah, so, I mean, I think it was funny. I was just looking at something before we started talking. Google has this function, Google, the web search tool, has this function where you can go in and ask, put down a couple of words, and it's called Google Trends, and see how often those words have come up in recent months. And I did this with income inequality, and I saw what I expected to see. I've been trying to introduce, elevate, amplify this problem for decades, and have been hard-pressed to get a lot of lift. Occupy Wall Street, in months, has introduced this issue of income inequality, of opportunity, of the lack of opportunity, the lack of accountability, the lack of economic mobility, into the discussion very effectively, very quickly. And for that, I think they deserve a lot of credit.
So I think in terms of the effects of Occupy Wall Street, I think it's gone way beyond those people in tents, many of whom, of course, have been removed, to a broader audience. But given the decades of government bashing that the political right in this country has done, and the extent to which there seemed to be a philosophy on the right in this country, in part grounded in this Ayn Rand notion that selfishness is a virtue, and that therefore the point is for individuals to gain as much for themselves as opposed to a sense of social responsibility. And I think the denigration of government over the decades has had its effect, I think, undoubtedly in this country. In many ways, it seems to me that the countervailing argument, which, of course, a part of the right's mantra is that we're taxed too much, it would seem to me that the argument could be turned around saying, well, it's not a question of how much you're taxed, which we happen to be taxed about the lowest in the world, almost. It's what you get back for your taxes. So is there any sense that in terms of building upon this new consciousness about inequality, it can go further into the reasons, as you've outlined in your article, why this inequality has grown? And in fact, the moral reasons, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
I do think so. I think the argument, as I suggested early, has a level of traction that it hasn't had in the past. In part, this has to do with the nature of our current economic dilemma. We sit in this country in a period of very high unemployment that we've been stuck with now for years. The recession, and while it may be waning on some official measures for many, I'd say probably most in the middle class and below, it still feels very much like a recession. Meanwhile, corporate profit rates have more than recovered, and they didn't get there on their own. They were helped by government bailouts. So the sense that the economy and the government is working for the benefit of the few and leaving many behind has the potential to have, I think, profound impacts among the American electorate. Now, the Tea Party, we know, has taken those kinds of sentiments and gone to a very anti-government place with them. Occupy Wall Street is different. While they're no fans of government, I think what they're targeting is the absence of opportunity and the absence of accountability. The failure of our economy, our society, to provide particularly young people with the opportunities they need to get ahead, or to hold some of the older people accountable for the way they screwed things up, motivates, I think, the movement. That's a pretty different kind of message. And ultimately, I suspect, and I even begin to see this morphing in that direction, I think not just the movement, but as you suggested, the kind of reverberations of the movement, the way the movement resonates beyond the camps, could very much move politics in a different and more progressive direction.
But it would seem, though, Jared Bernstein, that we need very, very strong and concerted arguments here to restore the very notion of government, which has been so maligned so effectively.
We need more than arguments. I think you're right. I think the problem is not just government's been maligned, it's that government has performed very badly. And in fact, it's a challenge to people like myself who make arguments that an amply funded, efficient government is absolutely necessary in a complex, interconnected global economy like the one we have today that's prone to devastating market failures. To make that argument, you actually have to have you have to be worried about not just market failure, but government failure as well. And we've got an extremely dysfunctional federal government right now. I don't think there is any mistaking that. So that's a big piece, part of the puzzle, too.
Well, I've, just from my anecdotal reporting of late, particularly on the Occupy movement, two things come out. One is that this kind of libertarianism that we're talking about is starting to gain traction with the young, and that the young who flocked to Obama in 2008 may well be susceptible to this. And secondly, that the Occupy movement is, in many of the people I've spoken to, quite hostile to the Democratic Party. And they just feel that our money-driven politics have captured both parties, and they don't see a difference between the two parties. So again, it would seem to be a pretty high bar here to reignite a sense that this movement which is out there can be translated into politics, because I fear that all this energy may not be translated into electoral politics because these young people don't feel they have a place to go.
There's a risk of that, for sure. But I've spoken to some of the folks involved in the movement. I did a pretty long interview with someone from OWS that should be posted somewhere on one of their websites. And my sense from her and a couple of other folks I've talked to is that they're in this for the long game. I think that your description is a very accurate one of the near term. But if you're truly part of a populist movement that is, I think, very rightly concerned about the absence of opportunity, the absence of accountability, the sharp increases in income inequality, and the diminished mobility that kids face, even kids with college educations. Ultimately, and the history of our country is extremely robust in the example I'm about to give, ultimately, there needs to be political and policy solutions. I think you're right to say that the movement is frustrated by the current politics, but I think it's absolutely the case, historically, that it's going to take public policy to address the injustices that they've identified. So they've got to be in this, if that's going to happen, they've got to be in this for the long game.
Again, I'm speaking with Jared Bernstein, who's a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. And from 2009 to 2011, he was the chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, executive director of the White House Task Force on the Middle Class, and a member of President Obama's economic team. So I guess the question then is, will Occupy Wall Street occupy the elections? And so far, there's no evidence, at least from the people that I've talked to. What's your sense, though, of the broader electoral landscape that's shaping up here for the president who you served up until recently? My sense is that paradoxically you could make the case that President Obama's re-election fortunes are in the hands of Angela Merkel, because if the Europeans don't get their act together in the next week to stop the bleeding on the mounting debt crisis, there will be a crash there, which will resonate across here and, of course, around the globe. And the poor economy that the president is running against would turn into a major millstone around his neck.
It is true that if Europe fails to get their act together pretty soon, I'm talking about the Eurozone in particular, the 17 countries that use the same currency, the euro, it could lead to a dip back into recession over there, particularly if some countries leave the Eurozone in a disorderly manner. I mean, you have to think about the very difficult implications of a country leaving a currency zone. I mean, basically, the way I described it in the blog the other day was, imagine you lent $1,000 to your neighbors, the Newmans, and you were expecting to be paid back $1,100 or something. Let's say you asked for 10% interest a year later, the Newmans came back and paid you back in $1,100 of a new currency called Newmans instead of dollars. Think about that, and you'll get a feel for what we're talking about here. That the impact on the American economy, which is already shaky, would obviously be negative. But there's a difference between a disorderly crash and one that's managed. If you think about Lehman, the investment bank that went down, obviously very disorderly and unexpected crash by many. If you think about the bankruptcy, on the other hand, of General Motors and Chrysler, very carefully managed by the government, quite different. So part of this is yet to be seen. I think on the electoral front, a lot of the president's fortunes will have to do with whether the unemployment rate is starting to come down, and that has something to do with policy measures that are currently under discussion. The unemployment insurance benefits need to be extended. There's a payroll tax cut holiday on the docket. So we'll have to see. I'd say it's early days, but it's not going to be an easy lift for an incumbent in a tough economy, no question about it.
But Jared Bernstein, when you mentioned the Lehman Brothers event, as it was called, in order to stop the global economy tanking and to rescue Wall Street, the Fed stepped in, pledging something to the extent of $29 trillion. Conversely, as my understanding is that the Europeans, in terms of building a firewall against the crash of the euro, they've only put up, as far as I know, €500 billion, and the European Stabilization Fund that they've set up has asked for about $1 trillion and has so far not even reached that mark.
How many trillion euros?
Sorry, trillion euros, yeah.
Yeah, that That 29 sounds awfully high, but I'm not.
Well, it's been quoted to me by a couple of economists.
Certainly there's no question that the Federal Reserve really put the pedal to the metal on this one and tried to flood the system with liquidity when that was what was needed, aggressively buying debt that banks were holding in order to increase their capital reserves and to relieve them of the impact of the non-performing loans that they were holding. Very, very aggressive and I think ultimately very important and successful work by the Federal Reserve. And by that I mean not that they were out of the woods, but that they certainly, I think, broke the back of a devastating financial meltdown. The ECB, the European Central Bank, simply hasn't done that yet. There are arguments that the ECB has a different mandate, that they're not really the lender of last resort, that they can't intervene. There's technical reasons they can't intervene as aggressively as the Fed. I think that's all just excuses and window dressing. There are lots of ways the ECB could do what needs to be done with the firepower of a magnitude that's needed, yet they're still kind of tilting against inflationary concerns at a moment when, you know, the ship is kind of heading toward an iceberg. So these are, I think, scary times for Europe. And the reason you have a central bank is expressly for times like, not just for times like this, but the reason you have a central bank that has emergency powers and that is insulated from the politics that make it quite difficult for some of the European leaders to do what needs to be done. You know, their populaces hate bailouts just as much, even more than ours do. So you could argue that their hands are somewhat tied, but that's why you have a central bank. And so we really need the ECB to step up here.
Well, this is, in fact, I think, an argument against Ron Paul and company, isn't it? They want to get rid of the Fed, you know, both on the libertarian right and on some parts of the progressive left are against the Fed. It's the absence of a mechanism that seems to be paralyzing the Europeans. But my understanding is that they have the resources, but they don't have the capability.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, and by the way, when we're talking about the Fed or the ECB, the Federal Reserve was printing money, and that can be a dangerous and unwise thing to do in an economy that's fully functional, up and running, where unemployment is very low, or it can be a very effective way of helping to offset the liquidity trap that we've been stuck in. And I think the Fed here has done the right thing. Look, Ron Paul and others who make that argument are very much beset by a kind of an ideology that is, as you suggested, very, very much libertarian, but I think at its root, you know, doesn't like an institution with this much influence that is unelected. And I understand that. I get that sentiment. There's a certain logic to it. However, I'm much more of a realist, and I think what's gotten this country into great difficulty, great trouble, and we'll get into much bigger trouble if we listen to people like Ron Paul, is to be guided by ideology instead of pragmatics and a real clear-eyed, hard-nosed look at what's going on. And we should have learned the lesson in the Great Depression that the absence of an aggressive central bank at a time when there's massive market failure is a recipe for unemployment that's unimaginably high. It was 25-30% in the Great Depression. That's where that kind of thinking will lead us if we pay attention to it.
Well, just in closing, Jared Bernstein, do you think that I understand the Italian Prime Minister warned that after the European summit next week, if they don't get their act together, there'll be no more room to maneuver. The deadline is December the 10th, which is looming. If they don't get their act together, it would seem to me that there could be a substantial shredding of the European social democracy. They have a much more developed social safety net than we do. There's also, of course, an unfortunate history of right-wing extremism in Europe, and we know that there's been evidence of growing influence of right-wing parties in Europe, or growing attraction, and there's Islamophobia and xenophobia loose on the continent. Give us a sense of how one, that might play out, and two, again, the follow-on to the United States, because here we are, have an administration that's trying to bring about something akin to a healthcare reform, not quite up to the standards of the Europeans, but at least an attempt in that direction. And what do you think the impact will be if this reversal takes place?
Well, I don't think it necessarily has to spell the end of the more progressive social safety net or system of social protections that some of the European countries have maintained. I mean, some of those countries, Scandinavia, Denmark, the Netherlands, France, Germany, well, maybe not France, but because they're facing some trouble too, but Germany, these are countries that are doing pretty well, or very well. Denmark's another, if I mentioned that, a good example of a country that, not in the Eurozone, but interestingly, they peg their currency to the euro and have maintained a pretty healthy economy coming out of the bust and a fairly robust welfare state. So I don't see any reason why that has to change. In fact, if anything, the restrictions that are being discussed now in terms of the fiscal policies that you have to agree to if you want to stay in the European in the Eurozone look far more strict than some of the practices and social welfare systems I just described. So, you know, that's not obvious to me. I think the problem is a very fundamental one. You can't have a monetary union that's not a fiscal union, or at least they haven't figured out how to do that yet. There's reasons for that have to do with, I would argue, some of the very feckless kinds of fiscal behavior we saw, like in Greece, but also there are macroeconomic adjustments that make it very tough. For example, for your currency to depreciate so you can export more if you have the same currency as other countries that are much, much stronger than you. So that's been a problem as well. So, I think that the transition, as I mentioned earlier with the example about the neighbor paying you back in a different currency than you lent them, I think the transition out of the Eurozone for some of these countries is going to be tremendously difficult and could be wrenching. But I don't think that I don't necessarily see anything like a disaster scenario on the other side.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Jared Bernstein.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Jared Bernstein. He's a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. From 2009 to 2011, he was the chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, executive director of the White House Task Force on the Middle Class, and a member of President Obama's economic team. Prior to joining the Obama administration, Bernstein was a senior economist and director of the Living Standards Program at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. He also held the post of deputy chief economist at the U.S. Department of Labor, and is the author and co-author of numerous books, including Crunch, Why Do I Feel So Squeezed?, and 9 editions of The State of Working America. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's visit to Burma. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Julianne Schober, who is director of the Center for Asian Research and co-director of the Graduate Studies in Religious Studies at Arizona State University. She's a professor of religious studies and an anthropologist of religion who works on Theravada Buddhist practice in Southeast Asia, especially Burma, Myanmar, and is affiliated with the Center for the Study of Religion and Conflict. Her new book is Modern Buddhist Conjunctures in Myanmar, Cultural Narratives, Colonial Legacies, and Civil Society. Welcome to Background Briefing, Julianne Schober.
Welcome to you, Ian. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
And the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, is in Burma, which is, for all intents and purposes, been closed particularly to the United States and has endured a 50-year military dictatorship, a very brutal one. Apparently, there is a sort of something in the wind. She met with Burmese President Thein Sein and then later with, of course, the pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi, who apparently Mrs. Clinton has always admired. What is your basic sense of whether this country is really turning in its direction away from military repression towards some glimmering of improvements?
Well, that's not an easy question to answer. I think Aung San Suu Kyi herself has called it an occasion for cautious optimism, and I think that's probably a fairly realistic assessment. From my point of view, there are a number of different factors coming together, and perhaps they came to the surface at the recent meeting of the nations of Southeast Asia, the Association of Nations of Southeast Asia, where President Obama also attended in Bali, and it appears that at that meeting, Myanmar or Burma once again put forward that it wants to be hosting these meetings in a couple of years' time, and I think much of the subsequent discussions were occasioned by that renewed pitch to take on a leadership position in that regional association.
So, Julianne Schober, what do you think it has allowed this general, who is now the leader, to take this course? Because not only is he has somehow been able to outmaneuver the hardline generals who have been running the place for the last 50 years, who are still in positions below him. And in the broader context, of course, the Chinese are interpreting this as there's been some actually quite hostile remarks on Chinese media about the U.S. meddling. So if the Chinese feel that the U.S. is trying to sort of move in on their turf, and they have supported these hardline generals, my assumption would be then that this moderate general, if he is indeed as he appears to be, has to look over his shoulder.
Well, I think that's the nature of politics in Burma. I think nothing is very certain except a certain sense of uncertainty. And he appears to be of a different generation in that his predecessor was older and had clearly a different outlook on politics and the practice of politics as well as a vision for the nation's future. I think this new leader is of the same generation, roughly, as Aung San Suu Kyi, and so perhaps is in a better position to share some fundamental concerns about the nation's future with her. She seems to think of him as a military general, clearly. Her own father is credited as the founder of the Burmese military, and she's always said that the military needed to be part of a national reconciliation. And I think at the same time, it's not as though you know, the new president has suddenly decided that he's going to implement rapid change. We are still looking at a long road ahead.
Well, but what has been going on, though, for the last 50 years, since 1962, when the military took over, has been a tremendous amount of brutality, ethnic warfare, the escalating in the protests that took place since Aung San Suu Kyi won the election and then was denied the 1990 elections, which she is supposedly won. The military refused to accept results. Then more recently, they even turned on the Buddhist monks who, my understanding, and since you are a student of both Burma and Buddhism, are deeply revered. They're in the DNA of that country. So it seems that the regime from which this general comes from is capable of the worst brutality. They have indicated a crazy kind of military megalomania by building this peculiar fortress-type city in the middle of nowhere, Ne Puy Thaw. Now, apparently, one of the main parts on the agenda with Secretary of State in discussing improving ties has been about the generals making deals with the North Koreans to get nuclear weapons. So that's surreal. Yeah. A poor country like this having a nuclear weapons program?
Well, that has been talked about for some time, and there have been some pictures on the internet about supposed sites under construction, and there have been ships, I suppose, that have been said to be carrying nuclear material that then were destined for Burma but turned around and so forth. So this, I can't assess to the extent to which there is a reality to all of this nuclear ambition or to what extent that is a ploy in negotiating politics. I think that, it's true that since 88, when there was a large-scale popular uprising that was crushed by the military, military regimes in Burma since even before 88, since 62, have increasingly become beholden to their neighbors in China. But I think there's also a desire among the Burmese to manage that degree of dependency. And so for the Burmese to be able to open up to international investments and to forge closer ties with the U.S. is a welcome opportunity. They have much to gain from this. And I think Clinton very astutely offered a review of the current sanctions as Burma moves towards implementing greater reforms for individual freedom and so forth. So this is a process. This is not going to be a quick solution. Yes, it's true. The most recent civil uprising. Has been led by monks and was brutally put down by the military. And it's also clear that there are a number of different voices within that military. I think we can see generational changes by now, and I think it's also clear that there have been those who are extreme hardliners and others who were more interested in promoting a national reconciliation and forming a nation that would include minorities or nationalities, ethnic groups that are located mostly on the periphery of the nation and that have always been reticent to join the national vision because often they are not only victims of war, but even after peace treaties, they remain basically second-class citizens with less access to whatever the state has to offer its citizens in a country like Burma.
Again, I'm speaking with Julianne Schober, who is the director of the Center for Asian Research and co-director of Graduate Studies in Religious Studies at Arizona State University. She's the author of Modern Buddhist Conjectures in Myanmar, Cultural Narratives, Colonial Legacies, and Civil Societies. So as I mentioned, Julianne, the Chinese state media have been a little bit hysterical and quite bombastic. They're not saying that there's anything wrong with the U.S. Improving relations with Burma, Myanmar, but they also warning the U.S. not to try and horn in on their kind of monopoly. Now, recently, a big hydroelectric project that the Chinese invested in was cancelled. So it would seem to me that there are, what you suggested, that the Burmese don't want to become a client of the Chinese. That may be a part of that. I'd like to get your input on that. But what is going ahead is this pipeline from all the way through from the south to the north, all the way through Burma into China, so that the Chinese don't have to ship their oil from the Middle East all the way around through the Straits of Malacca and up through the Pacific.
Correct. So if the dam was halted in order to lessen the negative impact of the construction of the dam on ethnic minorities, then and if that was a concession to the peace process and to the national reconciliation, one could say that the Chinese were the losers in that concession because they were going to be the primary beneficiary from the electricity generated. On the other hand, I think that loss got compensated with greater revenues on the oil that the Chinese are receiving from the Andaman Sea, and the pipeline goes through Burma North, as you said, into China. So it's not as though ties are completely severed in this relationship. Perhaps there's only a bit greater diversification, but I don't think that Burma is about to stop its trade with China and vice versa. But I think Burma does want to have a greater presence regionally with other nations bordering on the Mekong River. And Burma has a lot to offer in terms of its natural resources and a large labor force and so forth. So I think investors are ready and hope for an opening up in the near future.
Well, Julianne Schober, the Chinese have, of course, fairly got their foot in the door for some time. There's no question about that. But it's worth mentioning that Chevron of California, the oil company, has a 28% share in a big gas project, which it inherited when it bought Unocal. So it's not as if there's nobody from the West in there. And clearly this trip by Secretary of State Clinton is meant to not just improve ties, but also open up business opportunities. Just briefly, my understanding of the agenda that was discussed between Hillary Clinton and the Burmese leader were that the Burma, she urged Burma to cut its illicit ties with North Korea and fess up on the what the nuclear program's about, to end ethnic violence, and to start a joint search for the remains of U.S. troops killed in World War II. She also passed on a letter to President Thein Sein from President Obama. So I'm surprised about the World War II remains.
I am too. I suppose there are. I suppose this has to some extent become part of U.S. national policy that in their international dealings there is always an attempt to bring back home fallen soldiers. Yes. That was part of that conversation.
But I've understood, Julian Schober, that to some extent, even though they're a horrible government, treat their people brutally, and these generals and their ridiculous kleptocratic families have stolen the country blind. They have a certain leverage, don't they? They can play India off against China, and now there's a third party involved. Is that a strategy of Burma? In other words, they're sandwiched between two big rival emerging Asian powers, and the older hegemon now is trying to put his foot in the door.
I think that is part of I think that the Burmese government in general is engaged in a very complex strategy to move some pieces in a carefully strategized chess game here. And clearly bringing in another superpower is part of that equation. But also, I think to some extent, a certain recognition that Burma has to envision a new kind of future for itself, in the sense that it has to participate in digital revolutions and the kinds of economic changes that engenders. You know, it's economically already far behind what it was in the 1950s and early 60s. So there's much to be made up for here, and I think there is a certain interest in trying to make this happen at this point. So it's a complex arena here, and allowing Aung San Suu Kyi a certain degree of freedom, permitting some, giving some permission to public protests, very limited and so forth, and lifting some restrictions on the press and so on. That is all part and parcel of that, and we'll just have to see the extent to which this is actually allowed to become realized, or whether there is going to be some knee-jerk reaction and things suddenly shut down again. We hope that that's not the case, but it will take some time to ascertain.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Julian Schober.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Julian Schober, who is director of the Center for Asian Research and co-director of Graduate Studies and Religious Studies at Arizona State University. She's a professor of religious studies and an anthropologist of religion who works on Theravada Buddhist practices in Southeast Asia, especially in Burma, Myanmar, and is affiliated with the Center for the Study of Religion and Conflict. Her new book is Modern Buddhist Conjunctions in Myanmar, Cultural Narratives, Colonial Legacies, and Civil Societies. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the Amnesty International report that accuses Saudi Arabia of repression after the Arab Spring. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Ali Al-Yami, who is the founder and director of the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia. A native of Saudi Arabia, he has lived in the United States for many years, where he has advocated for political reforms in Saudi Arabia and provided testimony regarding human rights in Saudi Arabia before the Congressional Human Rights Caucus. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ali Al-Yami.
Thank you.
And the report by Amnesty International that came out Thursday, 73-page report, is very, very critical of Saudi Arabia. And, of course, I don't think there's any surprise to our listeners that the United States has a very hypocritical relationship with Saudi Arabia. It preaches democracy to everybody in the world except Saudi Arabia. And this report seems to indicate that Saudi Arabia is deliberately and aggressively going against the Arab Spring, I guess, is the best way to put it.
That's right. I mean, these are documented facts, and they... One of the examples is that the Saudis were adamantly against the downfall of Mubarak and also the for trying him in court. They are now working on uniting the last absolute monarchies, including Jordan and Morocco, to form a unity supposedly and to counter Iran's influence, but in fact they are organizing this group of monarchs to derail any democratic reforms in the Arab world.
Do you have any information, Dr. Ali Al-Yami, that the Saudis are financing the Salafists in Egypt? The Salafists have done surprisingly well in these elections, and along with the Muslim Brotherhoods could form a significant majority.
The Salafists in Egypt, the number is very small, and these are documentation. There is a book called The Looming Tower by, I believe, Christopher Wright, and it shows all the Saudi monies that go to different groups in the whole world, not just in Egypt. So it is documented, yes. But I mean, just to add to this comment you just made, and I'm not very concerned actually about the Islamists, whether in Egypt or Tunisia or Yemen or anywhere, to gain much power, because the people want something very different, and the Islamists have nothing to offer. They have nothing to offer except religious totalitarianism, and that's not what millions of Arabs are demonstrating against and dying for. So I can understand the apprehension about Islamists taking over, but I think that is over-exaggerated, maybe, but the test will come. But I'm very convinced, knowing what I know, that the Arabs want something a whole lot better than the Islamists could offer to them.
But what they have in Saudi Arabia is the most oppressive form of Islam, the Wahhabism. They have religious police, and they have an absolute monarchy that has, there's no parliament, there's no even pretense of anything else. And you can be put away for, I think, is it 10 years for just criticizing the king?
Well, no, you are not, criticizing the king is totally unacceptable, and it could it cost people a whole lot more than 10 years in prison. And you are absolutely right. Saudi Arabia is ruled by an absolute nomadic tribe called the House of Saud, and they consider the country as their private company, actually, and the people happens to be there as employees. They didn't believe in sharing power. There is no accountability. There is no transparency. And there is no religious freedom, no women's rights, no human rights, no civil society. And it's their days will be coming, too. It's a matter of time, not only because of internal uprisings and dissatisfaction with the situation in Saudi Arabia. But the international community, including especially the West, including the United States, have realized after 9/11 that Saudi Arabia is the hornet's nest, and religious extremism cannot be defeated unless Saudi Arabia is democratized.
But they've done absolutely nothing in that regard. I mean, that they just get bribed by the Saudis, and they need the Saudis so much, particularly now with this confrontation with Iran. Now they're trying to squeeze the Iranians through the central bank, which will mean that Iran can't get paid for its oil, except perhaps with China. And Saudi Arabia is going to make up the difference. So give me a sense of what influence that the West has, or has the West really tried?
I am very frustrated with our policy towards the Saudis. In fact, 4 people were killed a few days ago, and none of our officials said one single word about these are people, according to what I know, who are actually protesting peacefully. These are in eastern Saudi Arabia. And 4 of them were shot dead. And the Western media barely mentioned it, and none of the Western officials even raised their voice. I am frustrated with it. However, and the whole global economic meltdown have actually put us in a very, very a precarious position with Saudis and the rest of the Gulf region's dynasties, because we are pouring a lot of money in their purses for oil. And that money that we are paying them is actually, a lot of it goes to extremists and terrorists all over the world. These are not secret facts. I mean, the WikiLeaks document a few months back, quoted Secretary Clinton saying that Saudi Arabia is the biggest financier of extremism.
Well, that is, there's no question about it. But again, it does seem to be, you say, the deaths of these 4 people have been swept under the rug. It seems like that. By the way, there's an interesting series now on Showtime, a very good drama on Showtime that makes it clear that Saudi Arabia is the sponsor of terrorism. It's a dramatic film, but I was quite surprised at how honest it was and realistic it is. But specifically, Dr. Ali Al-Yami, the incident that you refer to was in the eastern provinces. And what happened was somebody was killed, an unarmed person was killed failing to stop at a checkpoint. But the others were killed the following day, and protests had erupted at a funeral. Now, that's exactly what's going on in Syria. So that seems to me the height of hypocrisy, that the Saudi Arabians are using the same brutal tactics that the Syrians are, while the Saudi king criticizes the Syrians.
Of course. I mean, that's not only hypocritical and ironic, but it's the peak of indecency as far as I am concerned. Here is a king who ordered his soldiers to shoot his own people in daytime because they were protesting peacefully, much, much more peaceful than any other groups, because they know, Saudis know, that they will be shut down without any hesitation by the Saudi security police. And here is the king calling in Syria to stop shooting at the government of Syria, at its people. I would like to see Western civilizations and Western democracies. I would like to see more open criticism of the Saudis, because it's actually in the West's best interest that we do not play this game, supporting revolutions and supporting revolts you know, in Egypt and Syria and Libya and to a degree in Yemen. In the meantime, quiet while the Saudis are shooting at their people, not only that, but they are sending their troops to crush the skulls of the peaceful Bahrainis who are also seeking justice from their own absolute chiefs.
Well, of course, all of that is blamed on Iranian conspiracies and the crackdown of the Saudis in the eastern provinces, which are largely Shia, are done under that excuse. But in terms of crushing the Arab Spring, just last week, 16 men, including 9 prominent reformists, were given sentences from 5 to 30 years. And they were blindfolded and in handcuffs during their trials, and their lawyers weren't even allowed to enter the court for the first of the 3 sessions. So, of course, they use, the Saudi royal family use these terrorism laws. They're interchangeable, the anti-terrorism laws, with anybody that's pro-reform. And, of course, they're holding thousands of people on these terrorist-related grounds. So, you know, they've got this excuse, a blank check, right, with anti-terrorism.
Well, the laws, they don't need to make laws. It's absolute monarchy, and the ruling elites could do anything they want. They are not accountable to any judicial system. Everything is under their control, the judicial system, the court system, the institutions, the monies. So they control every aspect of people's lives and livelihood. But this is just to appease the international community. We have these laws and books, and people should be aware what they should or shouldn't do. But this new law that came a couple of months ago and was published today again is absolutely designed to silence people from considering any uprising against the system. And just like in the past, before this law came about, anybody, the Saudi Interior Ministry under Prince Nayef, who is now the Crown Prince, and he is going to be the king of the country after Abdullah stopped functioning, which is now, actually. He's already handling the day-to-day operation of the nation or the country. So these laws are made to use against anybody who criticizes the king, who criticizes Islam, who criticizes the religious establishment. This is what this law specifically says. Anybody who criticizes any member of the ruling family or the religious establishment, which is they support each other, will be considered destabilizing the country and the security of the people and
therefore a terrorist, yeah.
Yes.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time, Dr. Ali Al-Yami, but I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Ali Al-Yami, who's the founder and director of the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia. He's a native of Saudi Arabia and has lived in the United States for many years, where he's advocated for political reforms in Saudi Arabia and provided testimony regarding human rights in Saudi Arabia before the Congressional Human Rights Caucus. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.